Hi, and thanks for joining me for Stories from the Phoenix New Times. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer, Chip Hawbrook. First on this week's program, we feel powerless. Phoenix rocked by ICE immigration court arrests. This story was written by Morgan Fisher and was posted on the Phoenix New Times website on May 23rd. On Thursday afternoon, a young mother of five kids, only one of whom is a U.S. citizen, stood in front of a judge at the immigration court in downtown Phoenix. She was asking the immigration judge to grant her asylum. She came to the U.S. from Mexico, seeking safety for her and her family after escaping domestic and cartel violence, State Senator Annalise Ortiz, who sat on the hearing, told Phoenix New Times. The mother told the court that she had been beaten by her boyfriend, who was a cartel member, and forced to provide information to the organization under threat of death. Lawyers from the Department of Homeland Security argued against her asylum claim. They said that she had assisted a group, the Jalisco New Generation Cartel, that the State Department has dubbed a foreign terrorist organization. The immigration judge ultimately rejected the woman's asylum claim. With the assistance of organizers from Puente and Borderlands Resource Initiative, two local advocacy organizations that accompany asylum seekers to their court hearings, the woman requested a continuance. She has 30 days to file an appeal and left the courthouse with her family. That's good, Ortiz said, that they didn't immediately detain her. If her hearing had been scheduled for one day earlier, she and her children may well have left the courthouse in handcuffs and headed toward deportation. Earlier this week, armed U.S. Customs and Immigration Enforcement agents, covering their faces with black neck gaiters, baseball hats, and dark sunglasses, stalked down hallways, waiting to pick up and deport immigrants when the government's removal cases against them were dismissed. Dismissal is normally a terrific outcome for defendants who face a traffic violation or criminal charge. But for defensive asylum seekers, it's perilous. For these folks, the government's removal proceeding itself provides them the opportunity to raise their asylum claims in immigration court as a defense to DHS's case. Without it, these individuals can face prompt deportation. Rapidly deporting migrants whose appeals for legal status could otherwise extend for months or years is one aspect of the Trump administration's mass deportation agenda. With these latest moves, the administration appears to be working within the law, but very, very aggressively. Courthouse protections no longer in effect. For asylum seekers, specifically those who have been in the U.S. for less than 2 years, the administration has been engaging in a process to expand expedited removal. To do that, the U.S. Department of Homeland Security prosecutors, through DHS's Office of Principal Legal Advisor, have been moving for dismissal of pending removal proceedings against asylum seekers. A statement emailed to New Times and attributed to an unnamed senior DHS spokesperson read that undocumented people who entered the U.S. within the last 2 years are subject to expedited removals, but posited that the Biden administration ignored this legal fact. Fernando Burgos Ortiz, the public affairs officer at the ICE field office in Phoenix, emailed New Times the exact same DHS statement. ICE is now following the law and placing these illegal aliens in expedited removal, as they always should have been, the statement continued. If they have a valid, credible fear claim, they will continue in immigration proceedings, but if no valid claim is found, aliens will be subject to a swift deportation. Applying for asylum, as some 900,000 people do in the United States every year, according to data from 2023, is legal and protected under international law. Immigration courts in this country face enormous backlogs of cases that, as they drag on, keep many migrants in limbo, yet do allow them to live legally in the United States. They're showing up, trying to follow the legal process, trying to demonstrate that they're doing everything that the government asked them to do. Beth Strano, the executive director of the Borderlands Resource Initiative, told New Times. It is really kind of a bait and switch. It's a subversion of due process. As part of the same enforcement agency, DHS attorneys and ICE are allowed to coordinate. Adriel Orozco, senior policy counsel for the American Immigration Council, a D.C.-based immigration organization, told New Times in an email that while he hasn't explicitly seen this type of coordination in the past, it is something that is expected. A long-standing Department of Justice policy prevented ICE agents from entering immigration courthouses. That changed once Trump took office. His administration rescinded those protections at the beginning of the year. More concerning, Orozco said, is the possibility that ICE and immigration courts are coordinating. It's not clear at this point, but we'll be monitoring to determine whether this was the case, he said. Immigration courts, like some other specialized courts, exist inside the executive branch within the U.S. Department of Justice. Immigration judges, therefore, are inside the same branch of government as the Department of Homeland Security lawyers arguing for deportations. But if coordination is occurring, in which a federal attorney approaches a judge without the presence of the respondent or their lawyer, that's a violation of court rules, said Robin Bernard, the senior director for human rights advocacy for Human Rights First. That would be a very, very serious problem, and the judge would probably accuse me of unprofessional conduct. There might be some kind of sanction issued by the court, she said. If there is evidence of some kind of knowing coordination between the judges and ICE, that would be very serious. Either way, in Phoenix and across the country, we see immigration judges dismissing cases over the objections of the respondents and respondent counsel, Bernard said. That is really concerning. Were arrests just a two-day sting operation? This week, social media feeds in Phoenix buzzed with videos of ICE agents escorting handcuffed detainees on the sidewalk of 7th Avenue and Van Buren Streets into a white van. The tactic kind of blitzed everybody, Strano said. ICE conducted similar activity at immigration courts in Los Angeles, Seattle, California, Texas, Chicago, Miami, and New York. After that chaos, Thursday morning was different. Instead of a strong ICE presence around the downtown Phoenix office building, which houses immigration court, elected officials, local organizers, and protesters took their place. Protesters held anti-ICE, pro-due process signs as drivers passed by and honked in support. Organizers with clipboards in hand offered guidance to immigrants before they went into hearings and often accompanied them inside. Inside the courthouse, elected officials, including Ortiz, State Representative Lorena Austin, and Phoenix City Council member Anna Hernandez, sat in to observe the hearings. Organizers also made sure that they had identifying information for every person who entered the courthouse, as well as an emergency contact in case ICE arrested them. If a person disappears, organizers can send that information to the Florence Project, which has the ability to go to organizations in detention centers, Strano said, and they will go find that person. It's unclear if the process of moving to dismiss was just a two-day sting operation, or if the public and media pressure is causing them to hold off and change strategy and course, Ortiz said. Either way, ISIS's surprise move is likely to have lasting effects, perhaps deterring immigrants from showing up for court hearings where they now believe they could be deported. But failing to appear at a hearing is a serious matter. In response, a judge can issue a removal order that would prompt ICE to issue an arrest warrant. You want people to feel like they can safely go to immigration court and follow the rules of their release and directions of the court, Bernard said. You don't want them to be too scared to leave the house, which is what many people feel right now. Organizers will continue to meet immigrants at the courthouse and provide them with information and a point of contact. Ideally, we're going to be here every day, Strano said, whether ICE is here or not. Still, the fear lingers. Through tears, Ortiz, whose West Valley district has many mixed status and immigrant families, said organizers told the woman with the five kids that she might be detained, pending the outcome in the courtroom. During the hearing, an adult took the kids elsewhere in case that scene unfolded. It's horrible, Ortiz said. We feel powerless, even as a legislator. Here's a story written by T.J. LeHeru and posted on May 23rd. Cop board punishes Phoenix sergeant for DUI, likely ending his career. Phoenix Police Department brass were understanding of Sergeant Edward Carnes' DUI, especially since the cop, who worked for the force for nearly two decades, had made efforts to change. On Wednesday, the Arizona board that disciplines officers took a tougher stance, suspending Carnes' certification for a year. The Arizona Peace Officer Standards and Training Board, known as ASPOST, licenses all enforcement officers in the state and is one of the few agencies in Arizona with the power to discipline police. The 12-member board includes Arizona Attorney General Chris Mays, two rural sheriffs, two police chiefs, Phoenix City Council member Kevin Robinson, and Ryan Thornell, director of the Arizona Department of Corrections Rehabilitation and Reentry. The decision came after 45 minutes of deliberation, in which the board heard from Carnes, who addressed the board in uniform. Carnes was arrested on March 18, 2023, by Queen Creek Police for a DUI with a blood alcohol content of 0.157. He was seen sleeping in his driver's seat before driving away and committing a traffic violation. The sergeant entered a plea deal in November 2023 and was suspended by Phoenix Police for 3 weeks. To this day, I still can't truly answer the question as to why I did what I did, other than it was God's plan, Carnes told the board. He attested that he had renewed his faith, started attending church with his children, and went to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings daily for a year. He said that life-changing events at the end of 2022, first world problems, he noted, put him into a bad place, and he didn't deal with his emotions. Being raised Irish as I was, I just kind of held that inside. I didn't tell anybody, I didn't ask for help, he said. I just went about the day carrying the weight of it, pretending nothing was happening. He said that on the night of his DUI, he was blowing off steam and had a plan that he wouldn't drive home. Yet, as noted by Bill Mundell, who is a board member and Arizona's chief deputy attorney general, Carnes took an Uber to his car. After his three-week suspension, Carnes continued working. He brought home nearly $130,000 in 2023 and $166,000 in 2024, according to city compensation data. A danger to the public going forward? Steve Cerbalik, the attorney who represented Carnes before the board, and who also runs a police defense YouTube channel, said that a suspension of a year would effectively end the sergeant's career. "It's unique because he's a sergeant," Srebelic said, explaining that sergeants are not allowed to be in non-enforcement positions for that long. It's not clear that there would be a position available for him. For the board, DUI cases tend to be the most straightforward. "I joke all the time that the board is consistently inconsistent," said ASPOST Executive Director Matt Giordano. "I can tell you in the 6.5 years I've been here, the board has been very consistent. And a DUI with this fact pattern has been a 12-month suspension." Srebelic tried to convince the board that Karn's personal reforms and the department's support to get him back on track were grounds to consider a shorter penalty. "God forbid that you have an agency from all of the levels up saying, we're going to look at the totality of the circumstances," Srebelic said. "None of that will matter, according to the state, because we have to do a year's suspension for that. Otherwise what? The public is somehow going to think these things aren't taken seriously? Otherwise, he's going to be a danger to the public going forward? That doesn't make sense." The board remained resolute. Only Mundell voted against the year-long suspension. 5 other officers were served suspensions during the board meeting, 4 of which were also a full year. Their transgressions included another DUI and improperly accessing a police database to research a neighbor. Mercedes Hernandez of the Apache Junction Police Department was suspended until August of 2026 for falling behind on 41 reports, 18 of which she failed to submit charges for, and improperly using a police database. So far this year, the board has punished 15 current and former law enforcement officers from across Arizona for such transgressions as driving an ATV through a playground with kids around while extremely drunk, submitting false timesheets, attempted sexual assault, and using a police database for personal reasons. The board has opened investigation into 14 other officers. Those include Phoenix Police Officer Timothy Clark, who went on a drunken rampage near Chase Field after a Diamondbacks game. He allegedly tried to fight a bar staffer, bit a security guard, and punched a framed picture. In 2024, ASPOST opened 48 investigations into officers and punished 43 cops, including for putting the muzzle of a gun to a woman's head, asking 2 high school girls when they lost their virginity, driving while under the influence, lying to superiors or investigators, and needlessly handcuffing an 82-year-old lady. Phoenix punts on getting rid of its notorious suicide lanes. This next story was written by TJ LaHerue and posted on May 22nd. Editor's note, this story was first published May 22nd and updated May 23rd to include a statement from Phoenix City Councilmember Laura Pastor. Phoenix City Council's meeting on Wednesday was a 5-hour barn burner. The house was packed. Dozens spoke during public comment, and the council passed a huge budget. But one thing didn't happen, to the dismay of several residents in attendance. The city didn't axe the suicide lanes on 7th Avenue and 7th Street. If you haven't driven on them, thank your lucky stars. Running from McDowell Road to Dunlap Avenue, these 2 major arteries in and out of downtown Phoenix bar drivers from using the middle lane to turn left, but only at certain times of the day, when the lanes are meant exclusively for cars heading south or north. complicated traffic signs explaining the lane rules add to the confusion, making it difficult for the unfamiliar driver to understand what the hell is going on. The suicide lanes appear to be widely unpopular. Roughly 84% of people who responded to a Fox 10 poll said the city should do away with them. For anyone who lives in Phoenix, listening to groaning about the confusing lanes and seeing accidents take place as a result of them is a common occurrence. Entering Wednesday's city council meeting, there was some hope that the notorious reverse lanes would finally meet their end. A citizen petition signed by roughly 5,000 people asked the council to get rid of the lanes for good. The lanes are dangerous and are also a drag on local businesses, the petition argued. Killing them, it said, would make it a more enjoyable experience to drive, walk, and bike on the sevens, and will make our community safer. The petition asked that the center lane become a full-time turn-only lane, rather than one that switches to one-way traffic in the morning and late afternoon. The council discussed it for a few minutes, and several residents spoke in support of the petition. But instead of taking action, the council punted. In a unanimous vote, the council instructed the city's street transportation department to complete a study and present it to the council by December of 2026, more than 18 months away. Activists who spearheaded the petition were pissed. What that council decision yesterday said to us is that our neighborhoods don't matter, said Stacy Champion, who lives near a reverse lane. Our neighborhoods that aren't as wealthy, I guess, just don't fucking matter to them. Much of Champion's ire is primarily reserved for Phoenix City Council member Laura Pastor, whose district covers most of the reverse lanes. During the meeting Wednesday, Pastor implied, but didn't explicitly say, that she wanted to end the reverse lanes. She said residents' desires to end the reverse lanes came up several times when she was running for office, and claimed that she caught flack for not committing to end them. She hasn't landed them, or rather she hasn't ended them, she added, because she does not have the necessary votes to sway the seven-member council. I'm not going to make a promise that I can't keep, Pastor said during the meeting. So today we're having this debate, and I don't have the votes to get rid of reverse lanes. Champion tweeted a video of Pastor's speech, which she called a word salad and insulting to this community. You can hear her whispering in the video that Pastor's comments were bullshit. Seriously, you can't whip four votes in 12 years, Champion said a day later, noting that she and others have been working to change the lanes since the early 2010s. You suck at your job if you can't do that. In a statement to New Times sent after this article was first published, Pastor said she appreciates Stacy Champion's voice and that she has been on record as advocating for the removal of these lanes in District 4 for years. But she added, we needed to prove the reverse lanes are unsafe and understand the consequential effects of their removal. My responsibility is to have staff provide the evidence for removal. The comprehensive study will provide the evidence needed to move forward. Competing studies. Pastor isn't the only council member whose district touches the suicide lanes. Councilmember Kevin Robinson's district also includes a portion of the lanes. In an interview with Fox 10, Robinson dismissed the idea that the lanes were dangerous and said that if you follow the rules, you'll be fine. A resident-backed study argues the opposite. Phoenix resident Jeremy Thacker, who has been a unique thorn in the side of city leaders and in the side of Pastor in particular, was involved in a study posted by Strong Towns Phoenix that showed pedestrians and cyclists were involved in only 1% of the crashes on the two streets, but account for 80% of the traffic deaths. That study doesn't lay out its methodology, but Thacker said in a text message that Strong Towns Phoenix used 15 years worth of crash data directly from ADOT and from the Maricopa Association of Governments. The study looked at the 7s as well as 19th Avenue and 16th Street, filtering the data to examine only the hours when the suicide lanes are in effect. In addition, the study found that the lanes have caused a total of $316 million in economic damage, doubled the crash rate compared to similar non-reverse lanes, and made life dangerous for pedestrians and bikers. It argued that traffic efficiency is minimal and negated by the frequent crashes, which cause an average delay of 15 minutes per day. By contrast, the city has argued that getting rid of the lanes would lengthen commute times. Speeding the drive-in and out of downtown was certainly their intended purpose. The reverse lanes have been operating on 7th Street and 7th Avenue since 1979 and 1982, respectively. Things were different then, activist Nicole Rodriguez pointed out to New Times. The lanes were approved when the Phoenix City Council had only at-large members, meaning the council members did not represent any particular district and may not have lived near the suicide lanes. Additionally, the system was created before State Routes 51 and 202 were created, in 1987 and 1990 respectively, to ease congestion in and out of downtown. Still, a 2021 City of Phoenix study found getting rid of the reverse lanes would increase rush hour traffic by 40% or more. At the same time, a 2024 thesis by Arizona State University student Mohamed Boukhamsin, whose co-advisor was the same city employee who led the 2021 study, found that there were several alternative options for operating the street that would be safer. The city already has more than enough data. What it lacks is the political courage to act on it, Thacker said. Instead of relying on clear crash data and community feedback, council chose to hide behind vague claims made outside the public process. Thacker said the decision to conduct another study comports with the city's normal inclination to stall. In Phoenix, delay is the city's greatest power, he said. It's how they exhaust residents into silence. Rodriguez agreed. She said she submitted a similar petition to repaint more crosswalks with higher visibility zebra-style patterns. The Federal Highway Administration found that such crosswalks can reduce pedestrians hit by 40%. The council voted to send that measure to a committee hearing to be decided. Putting it into a subcommittee, whether intentional or not, is often a delay tactic, she said. If you were serious about making changes, as a council member, you would have come to the table that day, ready to take action. Remember that if you missed any of the stories in this program, or any other SunSounds program, you can listen to them on demand. Just go to sunsounds.org and click on Broadcast Info and Audio. Then, click on On Demand Podcasts, scroll down to the program you're interested in, and click on Listen. The program continues now with this story written by Morgan Fisher, posted on May 22nd. Cat ladies celebrate Phoenix proclamation about stray cat problem. Like Missy Pruitt had done so many times before, she stood in front of a microphone Wednesday afternoon to call for the protection of Phoenix's outdoor cat population. It's become a similar scene for Pruitt. For the last several months, she has been a constant presence at Phoenix City Council meetings, where she called for the city to spend money addressing Phoenix's out-of-control stray cat problem. She wants Phoenix to shoulder some of the burden of trapping, neutering, and releasing these cats, known as TNR, and also for educating residents about how to deal with them humanely. But this Wednesday was different. Instead of waiting for her turn to speak during the public comment portion of a council meeting, Pruitt was talking to a much more interested crowd at a brewery less than a mile away. Her years of advocacy had paid off, at least in a small way. Pruitt, who owns the advocacy brand She's All Cat, gathered with more than 30 cat advocates in Grand Avenue Brewing Company to celebrate Phoenix Mayor Kate Gallego proclaiming May 21st, Feline Awareness and Education Day. Also at the event were a few local luminaries, donning a headband with pink cat ears and a blue and green sequin dress. Pruitt introduced Phoenix Poet Laureate Rosemarie Dombrowski, who read the Lawrence Ferlinghetti poem, The Cat. Also attending were Republican State Senator Shauna Bolick, who also has sponsored several pieces of animal welfare legislation, and Democratic congressional candidate and self-proclaimed cat dad, Amish Shah. With Gallego tied up at a city council meeting, a city staffer read the proclamation to the crowd. Millions of cats, both owned and unowned, are part of our communities, and their well-being is tied to the neighborhoods in which they live, the proclamation read. Education is a vital tool in addressing the root causes of feline overpopulation, neglect, and misunderstanding, and fostering responsible cat ownership and human care for all cats. Pruitt told Phoenix New Times she was excited about the proclamation, which she thought showed the city acknowledging that we have a crisis. She had been pushing for it. It doesn't cost any money, she said, but it also brings attention to all of it, to all of these different people. She also thinks the city may have issued the proclamation in part to shut me up, she said. She doesn't plan on shutting up or stopping her advocacy. It's a very small step, she said, but it's a huge step for advocacy in the long run. The Valley Cat Problem. Pruitt guesses Maricopa County has about 500,000 to a million outdoor cats roaming the streets of the valley. Constant births and the problems of disease and animal cruelty keep the population in flux. Despite the proclamation, the city hasn't put its money where its mouth is. The work of controlling the cat population has fallen to passionate cat advocates themselves, and they often pay out of pocket for their efforts. Sitting around a high-top table decorated with cat stickers and a large centerpiece of cupcakes with cake toppers in the shape of cats, Shalee's cat care owner, Shalee Ford, swapped stories with fellow advocate Ann During. They've nursed unhealthy kittens back to health in their homes and seen young boys kitten-napping cats from their moms. Ford's organization, which fosters and finds homes for outdoor cats captured during TNR efforts, has spent a significant amount of money on the procedures. In the last year alone, Shalee's Cat Care spent more than $3,000 on TNR efforts. This story isn't uncommon among Phoenix's cat advocates and trappers, who are hardly making a dent in the problem. Pruitt believes there is a more systematic solution to Phoenix's cat overpopulation. Education. The average Phoenix resident is generally uninformed about the city's cats and the intricate web of cat colonies. But Pruitt believes that more community education will take a bigger bite out of the problem. She does this now, but on a smaller scale than she'd like. She visits classrooms to speak to children, drops by community centers to speak to residents, and even speaks at corporate functions about the importance of TNR and how to protect cats. While the proclamation is a positive sign, Pruitt has been pushing the city council to help her expand this program. With funding from the city, she'd be able to go into classrooms at least 3 days a week and have several staffers help her achieve that mission. City funding doesn't appear to be in the cards just now. Phoenix is looking to save money in light of looming federal funding cuts. That means the job of curbing the cat population will be in the hands of Phoenix's cat ladies for at least a little while longer. Trump's DOJ rescinded its report on Phoenix police. What's that mean? This next story was written by TJ LeHoux and was posted on May 21st. Last June, the U.S. Department of Justice dropped a 126-page bomb on the Phoenix Police Department. After years of investigation, the DOJ issued a lengthy report documenting how Phoenix police officers consistently and systematically violated the civil rights of residents. The report was a means to an end, a DOJ push to submit Phoenix police to independent oversight. That report was written when Joe Biden was in the White House, and the DOJ had more of an appetite for curbing wayward police departments. Now that Donald Trump is president, the idea of suing Phoenix to mandate reforms went out the window when he re-entered the Oval Office. But the report remained. Not anymore. Sort of. At Trump's direction on Wednesday, the DOJ tried to put the proverbial toothpaste back in the tube. Wednesday morning, the DOJ officially rescinded the report, retracting the Biden administration's findings of constitutional violations committed by Phoenix police and at least seven other law enforcement agencies across the country. As of Wednesday afternoon, the Phoenix police report was still on the Justice Department's database. The decision to revoke the findings was announced just a day after Phoenix New Times reported the police department is the second deadliest police force in the country. Since 2013, encounters with Phoenix police officers have caused the death of 173 people, according to an analysis by the accident and injury firm Gamil Law. Only Los Angeles' police department killed more people. Arizona politicians reacted to the news with a mix of braggadocio and reserved approval. Republican Arizona Senate President Warren Peterson applauded the end of the DOJ witch hunt without actually refuting any of the report's specific findings or facts, while GOP Representative Abe Hameda tried to claim some credit for the report's rescission. The Phoenix City Council's lone Republican Jim Waring said at a Wednesday council meeting that the decision was outstanding news and dismissed the report as misguided. Democrats, including those on the Phoenix City Council, which resisted oversight and seemed to be running out the clock with the DOJ in case Trump was elected, have reacted more tamely. In a statement, Vice Mayor Anne O'Brien highlighted the department's reform efforts and said, "I have always been a strong proponent that the city council is capable of making necessary changes without costly federal oversight." Councilmember Deborah Stark said in a statement that she was very concerned about the findings of the DOJ report, but knew that our police department was already working on necessary changes. Representative Greg Stanton, the former mayor of Phoenix, released a statement that did not address the report being rescinded. Gone but not forgotten. The DOJ report may be officially pulled back, but it hardly vanished into thin air. It seems some Republicans want to wave a magic wand and erase the report from the collective consciousness, 1984 style. But considering many of the report's critics have yet to mount an evidence-based refutation, that seems unrealistic. For the large part, the findings were substantial and not challenged on their terms, civil rights attorney Bob McWhirter told New Times. None of the problems identified in that report, following an extensive investigation, have been fixed. To paraphrase Eddie Vedder, some reports, when released, can't be taken back. The DOJ's report has been public for nearly a year and widely circulated. And the notion that the Trump administration can erase it from the political zeitgeist verges on delusion. Last month, former Phoenix City Council member Carlos Galindo Elvira told New Times that the idea of rescinding the DOJ report might make some feel good, but it doesn't erase what was written. In a text message Wednesday, Galindo Elvira said that that interview now seems prophetic. So what does the DOJ rescission mean practically and for people who contend their rights have been violated? For one, yanking back the report hardly alters the reality on the ground. The DOJ report extensively documented a widespread pattern of civil rights violations carried out by Phoenix officers, including discriminating against people of color, using excessive and unnecessary force, and arresting unhoused people without cause. The DOJ said that the department taught officers tactics that were dangerous, unnecessary, and unreasonable, including that all force, even deadly force, would lead to de-escalation. The DOJ also found that officers fired their weapons at people who presented no immediate threat and improperly used choking tactics, including on people who had not committed a crime. The city has had to shell out for such abuses in the past. Between 2008 and 2018, Phoenix approved $26 million in settlement money for police violence in 191 cases. In November of 2023, the city paid $5.5 million to the family of Ali Osman, who was killed after throwing rocks at an officer during a mental health crisis in September of 2022. Kwesi Smith, who represented Osman's family in that case, said Wednesday that while the DOJ took a step in the wrong direction by rescinding its report, a step that he says places the police and the public in danger, he thinks the report's facts speak for themselves. The DOJ rescinding their findings does not change what happened in the underlying cases referenced in the report, Smith said. Everyone is entitled to their own opinion, but no one is entitled to their own facts. In a statement, ACLU of Arizona legal director Jared Keenan echoed that statement. The DOJ's damning and well-documented findings came from thousands of records, including hours of videos and interviews with personnel at the Phoenix Police Department. Now is not the time to look away, Keenan wrote. Our community demanded accountability long before the federal government stepped in. When Trump won the election, civil rights advocates knew that the idea of placing Phoenix under federal monitoring had become a pipe dream. Still, the report gave attorneys ammunition to using claims against the city. Lawyers have used it to show that the city failed to curb officers' violent tendencies, and in many cases, encouraged cops to be more violent. But after the Trump DOJ's decision, Smith is unsure if lawyers will use it quite so liberally now. I'm sure many civil rights attorneys will no longer reference the report as a source, he said. Not all lawyers agree. McWhirter told New Times that he would continue to reference the report in lawsuits. It still can be used in civil cases. The findings are there, so it doesn't change anything, he said. In fact, it makes some of those civil cases better because if they continue these same violations after they were put on notice by the DOJ's original report, then it shows worse conduct on their part. Still committed to reform? The report's rescission fully removes Phoenix from federal scrutiny, leaving police reform up in the air. For its part, the city says that it is still committed to fixing the issues the DOJ identified. Phoenix has maintained that argument all along. Before the report was released, the city pushed back publicly against the suggestion that its police force required independent oversight. Council members argued, as did former Police Chief Michael Sullivan in a closed-door December 2023 meeting with the press, that the department can reform itself more effectively. Whether that's true remains to be seen. Under Biden, the DOJ didn't buy the city's claims that it could police its own police and threatened to sue if Phoenix didn't accept any oversight mechanisms. The city's ability to create change also has been called into question by the bitter resignation of the head of Phoenix's Office of Accountability and Transparency in 2024, who said city officials stifled his every attempt to make the agency independent and robust, like the city claimed it was. The city also created a watered-down civilian review board, which has limited powers to impose change upon the police department. Phoenix cops managed to stir up a huge controversy just months after the report was released. Last year, ABC 15 revealed two Phoenix cops had beaten and arrested a deaf black man with cerebral palsy, jailing him for 24 days on bogus assault charges. Arrest video publicized by the station resulted in the Maricopa County Attorney's Office dropping the charges against the man, who is now suing Phoenix over the incident. Three cops involved in the arrest were suspended by the department for only 24 hours. Despite that, city officials insist that the department is well on its way to reforming itself, having already implemented a new use-of-force policy last year. City spokesperson Dan Wilson said the city has no plans to remove mention of the report from its website, where it posted numerous police files mentioned in the report in order to show transparency. From the outset of this process, the city and police department viewed the DOJ investigation as an opportunity to evaluate our operations, reflect on areas for growth, and reaffirm our commitment to delivering the highest standard of service, Wilson said in a written statement. He added that significant progress is already underway and will continue as we fulfill our responsibility to serve and protect the community while building trust through transparent, effective, and constitutional law enforcement practices. McWhorter was skeptical. "There's no evidence they're making such progress," he said. Similarly, activists in Phoenix urged city officials to heed the report. Now, more than ever, City of Phoenix leadership has a responsibility to acknowledge, validate, and take accountability for these findings, Ben Laughlin of Poder in Action said in a written statement. The department is now facing a new, uncertain chapter, let off the hook by Trump, but having made big promises about being mature enough to handle its business. On top of that, it's looking for a new chief. Sullivan, who helmed the department on an interim basis since 2022, resigned last month and took his name out of consideration for the permanent gig. The city has restarted its chief search from scratch. Whomever they pick will face a large challenge. Sullivan pushed for some reform during his time as chief. Not coincidentally, the rank and file disliked him. That likely means one thing for Sullivan's successor. If whoever takes the reins is serious about reforming Phoenix Police, they'll have to force the department to eat its vegetables. And Trump just told the cops that it's ice cream for dinner. Here's a story written by T.J. LeHoux and posted on May 19th. GOP state lawmaker rips the MAGA wing of his party in late-night post. The Republican Party controls both chambers of the Arizona legislature, the White House, and both houses of Congress. Things are theoretically good for those in the grand old party. But one GOP state lawmaker instead sees his party teetering on the verge of a crisis. In a lengthy Sunday night tweet titled, "The Republican Party Stands at a Crossroads," Republican State Representative Walt Blackmun decried the outsized influence of the party's hard right faction, railing against unnamed fellow lawmakers in his party and calling for more focus on the issues that really matter. As a Reagan Republican and combat veteran, I've watched with growing alarm as the party that once stood for order, liberty, strong defense, and economic freedom has increasingly embraced performative outrage over principled governance, Blackmun wrote. This transformation threatens electoral success and the foundation of conservatism in America. The sainted image of Ronald Reagan looms over Blackmun's post. Democrats might disagree on how beloved the 40th president should be. The traditional Republican platform rested on what Ronald Reagan described as a three-legged stool: faith, freedom, and force, Blackmun wrote. But his party's far-right wing, Blackmun never mentions Trump or MAGA, has effectively abandoned this balanced approach, focusing almost exclusively on grievance politics and cultural warfare. That same wing has mastered the art of internal censures and social media outrage, Blackmun continued. To underscore his point, he hearkened back to Democratic Senator Ruben Gallego's win over MAGA acolyte Kari Lake in the 2024 election. Again, Blackmun did not mention Lake. The 2024 Senate loss by 73,000 votes represents not a surge in progressive values, Blackmun wrote, but a rejection of Republican infighting and extremism by independents and moderate conservatives who still believe in traditional Republican principles but can't stomach the current atmosphere. It's not clear what prompted Blackmun to post the missive late Sunday night. The snowflake Republican, that's the town he lives in, not a pejorative, has not yet responded to questions from Phoenix New Times. But it's not hard to guess which far-right Republicans to whom he might be referring. Blackmun has bumped heads with a few of them. Clashing at the Capitol. Last year, he won election to the Arizona House of Representatives by defeating a particularly MAGA candidate in the Republican Party, Steve Slanton, who owns the Trumped store in Sholo. During that primary, Slanton was revealed to have fabricated aspects of his military service, deeply offending Blackmun, who was an Army veteran. Earlier this legislative session, Blackmun ran and ultimately passed a bill criminalizing the act of stolen valor, which is claiming or embellishing military service. To do so, though, put him in conflict with MAGA State Senator Wendy Rogers, who represents the same legislative district. Rogers is a huge Trump fan, an Air Force veteran, and a friend of Slatton's. She also sat on a committee that Blackmun's bill needed to clear and single-handedly prevented it from receiving a hearing. Earlier this year, Blackmun ripped Rogers online for getting in the way. Through a Strike Everything amendment and the help of GOP State Senator Sean Obolik, Blackmun's bill circumvented Rogers and ultimately passed into law. Before that, though, he erupted in fury when far-right State Representative Alexander Kolodin, whose votes are often controversial, cast the lone no vote against his bill in the House. "When you say no, you are saying no to over a million people that have put their lives on the line, half a million veterans in this state," Blackmun said on the House floor after Kolodin's vote, his voice building with rage. "You are saying, I don't care. I don't care that you died or had friends that died. I don't care. It's about the rule of law." It wouldn't be surprising if Blackmun was referencing those battles in his Sunday night post, though it's unclear how far up the party hierarchy his critique is meant to reach. Part of it seemed aimed at the Trump administration and its clear disregard for the U.S. Constitution. Reagan's conservatism wasn't a brand or a personality cult. It was a governing philosophy, informed by the Constitution and proven effective through implementation, Blackmun wrote. It balanced individual liberty with collective responsibility, limited government with necessary action, and American strength with diplomatic engagement. If we hope to reclaim this legacy, he concluded, we must reject the false choice between principle and pragmatism, recognizing that true conservatism encompasses both. And that brings us to the end of this week's program. Thanks very much for listening to Stories from the Phoenix New Times. Please stay tuned for additional interesting programs. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer, Chip Holbrook.